overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. We need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. But right now, please hold your calls. We have with us from Great Britain, Colonel Barry Turner, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in South America, what's happening in Europe. And, of course, if you read the American newspapers, you're not going to find out anything that's going on. Our media is controlled. It's designed to make the American people feel good and warm and fuzzy, but not to tell you the truth. And so we're fortunate to have Colonel Turner. He's been on with us in the past. Of course, he was with the British military, or I believe he was in engineering. But, you know, he now is retired. He has a completely different perspective of what's going on in the world. So, Colonel Turner, thank you very much for being with us. Oh, I hope we didn't lose him again. Well, let's see. Hopefully, they'll get him back on. We had him on just a moment ago, and then, of course, we lost him. So, he may be coming in on the other line. And under any circumstances, I think it's important that you begin to understand that Europe was deceived into going into the European Union. The whole purpose of the European Union was to establish this united one country. Their whole purpose was to lie and deceive the American people and of course, unite this. All right. Well, we're having some transmission problems, and we're going to see if we can get that straightened out. I'll be back here in just a moment, and hopefully we'll have Colonel Turner at that time. Well, Dr. Stan, hopefully we're going to have this thing straightened out anyway. The problem is that what they've done is they deceived the people of Europe. They told them that, oh, we want to unite the countries, but not to do away with national sovereignty. We don't want a common currency. We just want to open it up for trade. You remember how they came up with that line when they told us about NAFTA and CAFTA? But they're lying, of course. Their real purpose is to destroy the sovereignty of the United States, and so it was that the real purpose of the European Union was to destroy the sovereignty of the individual states. And step by step, first of all, we wanted to trade, and then a common currency, and then to have a common government with a loss of the sovereignty of each of the one individual country. And, of course, when it was put to a vote in France and one of the other countries, the people voted against it, but the elite really don't care what the people want. They have their own agenda. Colonel Turner, thank you so very much for being with us.
Good evening.
Well, tell us a little bit about what's going on as far as you're concerned, as far as the European Union. Has this been set back a little ways, do you think?
Well, I think it's a certain amount of turbulence over the sort of consolidation of the European Union, because the eastern states, the former Soviet satellites, of course, are coming on board. And the latest reports are, of course, that they have a lot of internal corruption.
You hold that thought there for just a moment. We'll be right back with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Well, certainly our guest this afternoon is Colonel Barry Turner. We're talking about what's happening as far as the European Union. So, Colonel, you go ahead and pick that story up, please.
Well, I think at the moment there's a lot of uncertainty. I'm no expert on European Union, although I've, you know, got all the historic documents that led to the present situation. But the former Soviet satellite states in the east, of course, are now joining or have joined the European Union. And it's a long process of adjustment. And, of course, we're back to this old bogey investment, which is one reason, I suppose, why these states are, if you like, being targeted. And, of course, from their own point of view, there is a certain advantage in joining the European Union, because investment is going in there, which means the big corporations are yet again, taking over the economy. And the ordinary sort of people are beginning to suffer, because the rationalization just happened in Latin America repeatedly, where they're now resisting. The ordinary people, of course, get penalized by the corporations competing, and everything becomes, in theory, more efficient, such as farming. You know, the peasant farming in these Balkan countries and the East is being gradually overtaken by commercialization. So again, you find this cycle of people threatened, people with perfectly stable existences, even though they're relatively primitive, being threatened by this incursion. And this is going to happen all the time. It's going to happen with public services, water, telephones, transport, you name it.
And, of course, this certainly is one of the big things in France. I mean, the French farmers were furious when they realized that they were going to be forced out of business by this whole idea of uniting Europe. And so they were really one of the major forces in blocking the acceptance of the European Parliament, weren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, they're much better organized than the English farmers, who are terribly passive. When the French take to the roads, they take to the roads and they mean it. And it's generally accepted, I think, that when it doesn't suit the French, and certainly people like the farmers, to follow the European Union diktats, they tell Europe to get knotted. And they fight hard. They fought against the McDonald's.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Barry Turner is with us this afternoon. We're talking about really what's going on as far as the European Union is concerned. The fact that the French and the French farmers specifically objected to going into the European Union because they realized it was going to destroy their independence, it was going to destroy their prosperity. And so the French really organized, and they refused to go into the European Union. Now, you have to understand the Olympians, the elite, call it what you will, the military-industrial complex, the corporate complex, they want this internationalism. They believe that they are so much smarter than the rest of us, and they intend then to impose the unification of Europe on the people of Europe, and here in the United States, the unification of the Northern Hemisphere on the people, whether they want it or not. So you pick up the story and tell us what's going on over there in Europe, please.
Well, I heard you mention at the beginning of the program the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, of course, was going to harness the Latin American countries, as I understand it, to the United States economy. Now, a further development of that in another direction on a sort of global basis was the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the MAI. Now, whatever reason, the public were told very little about this, and this is typical of the way the public is either kept in ignorance or dumbed down, because the MAI would have given the multinational corporations power to overrule governments when it came to investment, construction, and so on, and the establishment of their organizations in a host country. Now, when you have the ordinary people, who, after all, the whole thing is in the interest, supposedly, of ordinary people, the electorate. When you have governments elected by the ordinary people to represent their interests, and multinational, transnational, if you like, corporations are given the power by a global agreement to overrule those elected governments, then you're turning democracy on its head. It's quite absurd. The Royal Institute of International Affairs wrote a very interesting report on the MAI. And because the Royal Institute like the Council on Foreign Relations, has a very much a foot in the corporate camp. The global power brokers, of course, which was being very equivocal about its view on the MAI, to the extent, in my view, reading the booklet, they were all for it, but they were having to admit defeat, and the defeat came from France. Rather like José Bové, who leads the French farmers in this resistance, the French dug their heels in. But you see, if I can step sideways, you come to an astonishingly hypocritical approach to the entire business. And I've been looking at the reports on oil. Oil and gas now, as we know, are key commodities and threatened with a limited future in so many decades ahead. China's on stream now, struggling to obtain its own oil supplies. And we have this situation where Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has taken control of the investments by these corporations. Then we have Morales in Bolivia doing the same thing. Now we have a report in the Financial Times yesterday that Palacio in Ecuador is following suit. But you see, you have. And this, of course, is a knock-on, I suspect, from the weakness of the United States with its huge commitment in Afghanistan and the Middle East. This is where these nations are beginning to smell cracks in the facade. Now, it's very interesting that when you look at the morality of this, George Mondiot, who writes in the British Guardian newspaper, wrote under the heading, "When two poor countries reclaimed oil fields, why did just one spark uproar?" And we have the question of Morales in Bolivia, and it refers to George Bush figuratively making a speech about freedom and democracy being threatened by freedom and democracy.
Well, in other words, because Morales, who was democratically elected, is doing what he was elected to do, and that is he's saying, look, you have these sweetheart deals. These companies have come in here and bribed the people who are before me and taken away our natural resources, which is our natural gas, and we're simply not going to abide by the corrupt contracts that you bribed our officials to take. Now suddenly he's a terrible guy.
Yeah, but you see, what Mondiot does is contrast this with a similar situation in Chad, where there's a ruthless dictator who actually went along with the multinational corporations, with the oil corporations. Nobody said a word about him because it suits their objectives.
Well, of course,
it's a totally equivocal approach.
Well, of course, in Angola, for many years, the communist dictatorship there, and it is a communist dictatorship, has been financed by Chevron Oil Company, and because they've gone along with Chevron Oil Company, Chevron Oil has financed this ruthless tyranny and certainly helped them defeat the people who, under Jonas Savimbi, who wanted to be free. So we finance communist dictators throughout the world as long as they go along with us.
Yeah, and of course, in the case of Angola, we knew perfectly well what was going on because Cuban troops with Soviet advisors were guarding Western oil interests. And there you have another of these contradictions where we still had the Cold War at its height. The British and American troops were in Europe facing the Warsaw Pact forces, and yet here we were with communist Cuban troops with their Soviet advisors defending our oil interests. It was Gulf, wasn't it? Gulf, then later Chevron. I think I got it the right way around. But you see, there's another interesting article in the Sunday Telegraph, the 23rd of May. It's headed Black Gold Diplomacy. And the subtitle is Securing Supply Lines is a Key to Military Strategy. In other words, we blow this nonsense about liberating the people, for instance, of Iraq, bringing freedom and democracy, what we're after is stability, one way or another, by hook and by crook, to, in this case, suppress a potentially rebel state, that of Iraq under Saddam Hussein, to ensure the oil supplies. And this, of course, is the common pattern. You find, you know, being imposed across the globe.
All I can say is we've done a very, very poor job in Iraq because they keep blowing up the pipelines there. And who benefits from that? Why, the oil companies, because they have made certainly obscene profits this last year since we went into Iraq to secure the oil. And since the rebels or somebody's blowing up the pipelines there, so the big oil companies have really benefited by the artificial shortages created because of the war of Iraq. So things are never quite what they seem to be, Colonel.
Well, I think in the case of Iraq, the place is in absolute chaos, quite
right.
honestly.
And why should it have been? After all, they had a stable government before we went in. It seems we did everything we could to destabilize that government, dissolving the army, dissolving the police force, dissolving the civil service, and creating the chaos that plagues that tragic nation today. Why would we have done something that stupid unintentionally?
Well, absolutely. What is interesting is that at the early stages of the occupation, when things began to go wrong, one comment was that one day they would have to bring back Saddam Hussein. Now, this has been hinted at in recent times that, you know, matters were much better under Saddam Hussein, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, he was a ruthless dictator. But you see, there was an article in The Guardian this week by an Iraqi who was really certainly no fan of Saddam Hussein, but watching the trial, he did have to admire the way Saddam Hussein was standing up and saying, I am the legitimate ruler, and refusing to acknowledge his trial. The other thing is, of course, that the coalition powers who have to be behind this whole thing have clearly made sure that he is being tried on one specific atrocity, that of a town where there was an attack on Saddam Hussein and he retaliated. Now, they're very careful not to try him on the wider front, for instance, of the gassing at Halabja, which was a far worse crime, because that would draw in people like Donald Rumsfeld personally with an equal responsibility.
And of course,
and the coalition powers, or what became a coalition power, supplying the technology and the equipment.
And in fact, Saddam got the material to build his chemical warfare agents and his bacteriological warfare agents from the United States. We funded him to the tune of between $5 and $10 billion after he killed all those people in Kurdistan. I think it's 10,000 people, I've forgotten, 10,000, 100,000.
Yeah.
We still backed him after he used poison gas against the Iranians in violation of every international law. Why we still backed him, in fact, I've talked to people from special forces who were sent over to help Saddam, you know, use the poison gas on the Iranians, and they killed 1 million people. But they're not going to try him on that because, of course, he would bring up American complicity in that, and why we couldn't have that. Saddam Hussein is a wicked man, and he is a wicked man, but we have wicked men in our own government. We have wicked people working at the highest level of our society today, and many of them that were there during those Reagan years when we were backing and financing and encouraging and, of course, doing everything we could to keep Saddam in power and to help him with his victory over Iran. But then we were helping the Iranians, too. Isn't it interesting how it all works out? We'll be right back with Colonel Barry Turner. Well, Colonel, you go ahead and pick the story up there.
Well, I mean, you can flip the coin again with Madeleine Albright when she was Secretary of State to Bill Clinton, saying that 500,000 Iraqi children were worth the price. I mean, that is a matter of record. There's no argument about that.
Those were the Iraqi children who were killed because of the American embargo when they couldn't get medicines or any of the things that they needed. And 500,000 Iraqi children died, and And Madeleine Albright said that was perfectly all right. It was certainly worth it. That the trouble was, if you read the book See No Evil by Robert Baer, who is a CIA agent, he will tell you that in 1995, the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we wouldn't let them. Earlier, the Iraqi military had tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we betrayed the Iraqi military. So we were keeping Saddam in power. In fact, Robert Baer made the statement, he never met an Iraqi who didn't believe that the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. So certainly Saddam Hussein is a wicked man, but aren't the people in our government, in our State Department, who kept Saddam in power, aren't they equally guilty?
Well, let me go back 40 years, just as a side issue, as a question of morality, and this question of freedom and democracy when it suits us. The evacuation of the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean to establish, enable the United States to establish a massive air base there. Now, 2,000 inhabitants were evicted by the British government, British passport holders in theory, and shipped on a ferry to Mauritius. Now, John Pilger just produced a book. His latest book is about this episode. And a friend of mine, Felicity Arbuthnot, a freelance journalist and an expert on Iraq, has been just received a copy. So I only know that much as quoted from it. But apparently these 2,000 people were shipped on the lower deck of a ferry. The horses were saved from the islands. They were on the upper deck. So they were urinating and defecating through the, you know, the boards of the upper deck onto these poor people, and they were taken to Mauritius and dumped to live in abject policy.
Were they paid for seizing their property?
I don't know what happened to their property, but they certainly lost what they had there. There's no doubt about that. Pretty arbitrarily, and this was these were British diplomats, I would imagine. I've yet to see the details, as I say. Apparently, dogs, for instance, were simply killed. They weren't taken. And a number, I believe, were just thrown onto fires to kill them. Now, when we have this aspect of morality and then go around the world preaching freedom and democracy to anybody, you know, it's total hypocrisy. And I think ordinary people have got to, as they say, wise up and learn what this is all about. But in this country, you know, you're facing an uphill battle. You do get these reports in the press, and you get a book by John Pilger, which certainly won't be reviewed in the mainstream press. They won't publicize him. But you see, when you get a major news broadcast by the BBC television, in which the first two of three items are about football, I mean, you know, it's standing logic on his head. And, you know, ipso facto, people are kept in ignorance and dumbed down.
Hold that thought right there, Colonel. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Colonel Barry Turner, and he's simply talking about the dumbing down of people in Great Britain. But then the same thing happens here. In fact, the fate of Great Britain and the fate of the United States is very, very closely intertwined. So, Colonel, pick up this story.
Well, yes, I mean, it is a question of people becoming aware of what's going on in this world, because behind the whole thing, of course, is the economy, is money. Money is the lifeblood. It's a circulatory system which controls everything else, as, you know, we discussed before. And you go right back to Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, which brought the whole thing up to date in the 1970s, But as long as money is allowed to be created virtually without limit, and therefore can be used to finance, to bring life to more and more corporate power, then we are not going to get out of this situation. And people, of course, as we know, just as corporations, and we've quoted General Motors and Ford in trouble, and there are plenty of other corporations in trouble who run on debt, because debt really has to, it's rather like chasing its own tail. And people, as well as governments, are in huge debt now. We're running into trillions. trillions of pounds in this country, individual debt, which can never be repaid. We have a big problem with student debt. Now, this is a one-way movement because of the nature of money and its creation. And, you see, we bring the whole thing back to ordinary people on the ground, and until we have a much stronger relationship between local government at whatever level, I would suggest in the United States as well as in this country, where we control our politicians and direct our politicians, we are never going to resolve the present situation, because money is feeding everything else. It's feeding military excursions. And things have really got so far beyond the national boundaries, the nation state of whatever size, which of course is another question. We're not going to get civilization back on stream. In fact, we're going to destroy ourselves. Civilization is going to destroy itself.
Well, I think, Colonel, what we have to do is look at history, and we've seen this happen in the past. We saw this happen in the late 1920s and 1930s. Massive debts created by the irresponsible Central Bank of the United States working in concert with the Central Bank of Great Britain, creating a great, of course, artificial affluence. Everybody was making money, everybody was happy, and then suddenly, to save the monetary system, they had to contract the monetary supply, and they simply did away with the debt. They simply destroyed the debt, and in the process they destroyed the lives of so many Americans and so many people in Great Britain and throughout the entire world. This was not simply an isolated incident. It involved the entire world, and the only way out of this terrible depression of the 1930s was World War II, with 100 million casualties, both killed and wounded. I wonder, of course, as we're facing the same thing today, we see, of course, our stock market beginning to reflect the uncertainties of our financial system. People talk here in America about the danger of inflation, but inflation is a byproduct of the banks having created money artificially out of nothing. And, of course, the day of reckoning is about upon us, as we see the price of gold and silver and other things going up. And I wonder if the way out of the coming economic chaos will be another world war. What are your thoughts on that?
Very difficult to identify the trends. Certainly, you see, we're back to ordinary people in poverty. And what we have, of course, is all the wealth we need to grow food we need. Are in this country to satisfy the World Trade Organization and the movement of goods, food, the unnecessary import of food, which has meant our milk farmers are going out of business. We've had orchards, apple-growing orchards, raised. We didn't need this to feed the people of this country, and I think it applies all around the world. And of course, indigenous economies in the third world have been turned on their heads to produce the sort of goods that we want to consume in the West. And you know, the whole thing is out of balance. And we're talking ultimately, of course, about money as so much candy floss. I mean, the people who create the money don't grow as much as a carrot. They produce no wealth at all, only on paper.
But of course, that paper wealth, as long as people will accept it, the trade continues. When people realize that it is like monopoly money, with the monopoly money, there's only a certain amount of money on the board. With fiat money systems we have in the world, they can print all they want to. We've had a great run, a great prosperity, but the day of reckoning is just about upon us. We'll be back in just a moment with Colonel Barry Turner. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Colonel Barry Turner. Colonel, what are your thoughts about the Middle East, and do you really think we're going to have some sort of a conflict with Iran, or is this just a lot of hype?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be popular with a lot of people, but I believe that, and it may be, you know, cloud cuckoo land thinking, in practical terms, but I firmly believe that until Israel is brought to heel, even to the point of putting a powerful United Nations force into that part of the world, as they have in Cyprus, then nothing is going to be resolved. And a lot of the discussion centers around the nuclear build-up in Iran. And this is a big talk-up. But until Israel is made to declare its nuclear weapons, which everybody knows it's got, then nothing is going to be stable, because the whole of the Middle East is only too well aware of this. Now, I don't believe Israel has anything to fear, because with the United States behind Israel, I don't think anybody's going to move in on Israel. But they have got to stabilize that part of the region and stop playing politics.
But how can they?
Political influences behind it.
But how can they, when Pakistan has nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons that they've gotten from Pakistan because they financed them, Russia has nuclear weapons, certainly China has nuclear weapons, India has nuclear weapons. Can you ask Israel to give up their nuclear weapons when so many of the other countries, and even countries that really, of course, would like to see them destroyed, would have nuclear weapons? You'd have to disarm the whole world, and nobody's going to be the first one to do it other than maybe the United States.
Well, yes, the United States would have to take the lead, and thereby you have a problem because of the vested interest, the factional interests within the United States, which would be well publicized. J.J. Goldberg himself, as I quoted before, wrote about this. In other words, wrote about his own culture and the power which was integrated in the political scene, the AIPAC and the rest. But you see, Israel has a population of something like 5 to 6 million, and they have suffered terribly. Innocent people, not the military element, but innocent people have suffered, just as people have suffered elsewhere. But you see, for a state of some 5 to 6 million to be a military power on a global basis, this is absolute nonsense. They should be dealing in agricultural produce and the tourist industry. They're very clever technically.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. All right, Colonel Barry Turner. Colonel Turner thinks that certainly we will not have peace in the Middle East until Israel has been brought under control. The difficulty is that Israel is not about to give up their nuclear weapons until Pakistan and India and China and Russia and the other countries around them, Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons, nuclear-tipped weapons, until they're all ready to give up their nuclear weapons. And I don't see any of those countries giving up their nuclear weapons, do you?
Well, I don't think so, but you're talking, again, we're back to a state of 5 to 6 million compared with what? A billion and a third in China. That's a different ballgame altogether. Pakistan, of course, has been allowed to get its nuclear arsenal together because that's suited the global power brokers, the global power play. We've seen them acquiring nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union has had them, of course, since pretty well the end of the beginning of the Cold War. So that is already established.
And of course, when you have a nuclear weapon, there's an awful tendency to want to use that nuclear weapon. It's one thing to say we need it defensively, but you know, my concern is with all these nations armed with nuclear weapons, somebody is going to utilize those. In fact, there's even been talk of the United States possibly using nuclear weapons to try to neutralize Iran's nuclear sites, or maybe even Israel. And we've had this on fairly good authority that Israel has nuclear-tipped cruise missiles on their submarines. They have a small submarine fleet, and those could be utilized to attack Iran's sites. So my concern, Colonel, is could we be on the edge of a precipice? Could we be on the edge of a nuclear confrontation in the Middle East? And if there were, could we have any guarantee it would not spread to our own shores?
Well, a lot of thinking during the Cold War, of course, was the nuclear stalemate and the fact that the nuclear weaponry was so terrifying that it was largely symbolic. Now, another approach to the question of Iran, who are only just, you know, saying, well, other people have got it, why shouldn't we? And the Soviet Union and China I believe, are digging their heels in over any Security Council motion on Iran for sanctions and so on and so forth. So you've already got a problem building up, if I'm correct. But you see, Iran has huge oil reserves. Now, it is known that Iran was proposing to establish an independent oil bust based on the euro. Now, what is that going to do to the dollar? Is this really the nub of the problem, and not nuclear weapons or nuclear power? I mean, the claim is nuclear weapons. It doesn't mean to say that this is correct. Are we talking about weapons or nuclear power? To generate the generation of power for the infrastructure of the country. But in any case, by the time Russia plays its cards and China plays its cards, unless we have a monumental risk looming, it can only remain a stalemate. But we still have Israel, which is given little publicity in this matter. I repeat, it's a tiny state by comparison with a huge arsenal. I mean, I don't suppose even the United Kingdom, as a supposed member of NATO and in collaboration with the United States, has that autonomy or that degree of nuclear power, nuclear weaponry. The French go it alone, but they always have. But you see, we have this imbalance, and nobody will come clean and look at the whole thing. Perhaps, you know, one's blowing into the wind to expect this to happen with the present global power play.
And, of course, the thing is that if we look at this thing from a purely geopolitical point of view, but there is also a prophetic and spiritual point of view, then perhaps there is another agenda out there that none of us really understand. And yet, of course, we'll draw many of these countries in the Middle East into a major war, and I fear into a nuclear confrontation. So it may be illogical, but then so much of what goes on in the world today is illogical.
Yes. Well, it takes a lot of understanding. There may be a logic behind it, as I think you're inferring, but we certainly are not fully aware of what it might be.
Amen to that. I certainly would concur with that. Well, I think we live in very, very uncertain times, and so I think that there's a phrase in the Bible, something about Israel being a cup of trembling. In other words, certainly this one little country and this one little city of Jerusalem, you know, being really the center of so much of what's going on in the world, it has been pointed to the ancient prophecies, pointed to the fact that would be happening, you know, at the approaching the end of times. It's going to be interesting to see how the story unfolds. Well, what do you see happening in South America, certainly with Hugo Chavez and Morales and so many of the leaders there turning to the radical left? And it would appear that Hugo Chavez is almost doing everything he can to inflame anger in Washington, D.C. towards him as he rants and raves against the evils of the Yankees. Do you see a confrontation coming in Central and South America with America as well? Because remember, of course, wherever America goes, England goes. Wherever England goes, America goes. So our destinies seem to be intertwined, whether we want it to or not.
Well, when you talk about our destinies intertwined, they're certainly intertwined. Well, you take the big oil companies. BP Amoco is one of the biggest, possibly the second biggest, after Exxon. So our interests in that, from that point of view, are right up front, just as we see the same corporations moving into the Antarctic and threatening the ice cap further. They've moved into Alaska. They're desperate to find these new resources, these deposits. So our interests are intertwined to that extent, and of course a lot of business is intertwined. I mean, like the big American motor corporations are well into Europe as well as into the United Kingdom. But whether morally our present Prime Minister is on sound ground, I very much doubt. I mean, we know the history of Prime Minister Blair and his initiatives around the world. So much, again, so much candy floss from a man who's not even run a ministry in the government, let alone a company of any sort, any organization of any sort. But as far as Latin America is concerned, one gets the impression that the Latin American countries, after all, I mean, dictators have been imposed and deposed to suit the power play in Latin America. This has been manipulated externally, as we know, largely from the United States, which has made it clear in the past that Latin America is their own particular parish, their backyard, their stomping ground. You see, you have Pinochet in Chile. Now, it's fairly clear that the United States and the United Kingdom have seriously overcommitted in the Middle East and in Afghanistan. Every day shows that matters are getting a damn sight worse, not better. And the Latin American countries have realized, quite obviously, that this is the time to break away from this economic colonization, which it is. We have gone ahead in the West, largely our two countries, I'm afraid, by behaving as colonial powers did 100, 200 years ago. Now, we are supposed to be a civilized world, non sequitur, but there you are with the United Nations to keep the lid on things, and, you know, freedom and democracy and prosperity for all. But our actual behavior is still exploitation. We don't go and shoot the natives. We merely harness them economically to our own ends. And it's understandable that Latin Americans are now taking the reins when they see this weakness. You see, Iran is keeping the thing going. China is threatening and moving in to secure oil supplies in Africa in a big way. There's a lot of competition there and a lot of worry. The former Soviet Union, Russia, has its own game and its own resources, so they're a powerful influence. But we are militarily so overcommitted at the moment, we couldn't go into Latin America if we wanted to. And they know it. And I'm afraid there is strength in numbers, because you've got three important countries there. Now, you have Cuba already in the frame. And another one, which is interesting, and I have no idea how it's going to pan out, is Qatar. Now, there were reports in the paper, I haven't got them to hand, about the economy in that part of the world, in the Persian Gulf, becoming much stronger. Now, whether it's a sort of another South Sea bubble with all this development, I don't know. But certainly, as these nations begin to consolidate and develop with a lot of inward investment and their own enormous oil wealth, then others are going to join them. And it's going to be a force to be reckoned with, quite possibly. I mean, one can only read the reports in the various newspapers and various articles in magazines and so on, and put two and two together, because I have no exclusive source. I can only read and draw on 20 years of research and study. And, you know, at my age, a lifetime of sort of watching it happen. And I think this could be an interesting one, but we still have to resolve the Middle East. And if I can bring us back to Iraq, I notice from the press that 44 United States soldiers have been killed so far this month, and another four were killed today. Now, this really suggests that things are getting pretty desperate. There's no sign of a stable government. Because there's still no agreement on the foreign and defense ministries in this Iraqi parliament, government. And it's been reported that one person is killed every hour in Basra. Now, this is a very reliable journalist called Patrick Coburn, who writes regularly in the London Review of Books and in The Independent and The Guardian. Now, when somebody like that reports a fact like that, then, you know, things are coming apart at seams. Now, we've lost 7 British troops from the coalition in the last few days. And again, you know, it's hopping up. It seems we can no longer go on patrol in berets. We're now having to wear helmets. Now, when that happens, things are going wrong. Now, it is believed that the police are involved with the insurgents. And another report, which appeared in The Independent on Sunday last weekend, Iraq trembles as army units start to fight each other. Now,
you're talking about Iraqi units that we have trained and we have armed fighting one another. We have created a total situation of total chaos there. Well, how could you have done such a poor job unintentionally?
I think it's pure ignorance. The British have certainly learned nothing since the 1920s. And what has happened, of course, apart from it's a number of factors here. But what we did, of course, was withdraw our diplomatic representation prematurely. So our intelligence network on the ground really sort of withered on the vine, and I believe the United States did the same. And we simply have no understanding in depth of the culture and the very fabric of the region. And it was put to me that we went ahead and we recruited these new police forces and the new army, and we had no idea exactly what the tribal origins and the cultural origins in this fine mosaic of rivalries were involved in this recruitment. And as Felicity said to me only last night, she said, you know, we would take anybody on board and train them, even if they didn't speak Arabic. But to us it sounded as though they spoke Arabic. They could have come from anywhere. Now, they're all in uniform. And one thing Saddam Hussein did, at a far less cost, certainly not one person a day, every hour dying in Basra, what he did was weld the country together as one. And, of course, along came that genius, Royal Paul Bremer, who not only set the scene for the corporate rip-off, but he dissolved anything to do with the Baathist Party, which, as everybody knew, involved, you know, ordinary people, civil servants, teachers, and so on and so forth, who'd merely gone along with the prevailing power. They weren't dedicated Baathists in the extreme sense. And, of course, the armed forces went along the same, suffered the same fate. So there was no coherent, cohesive infrastructure on which to build.
Well, of course, Paul Bremer comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a very brilliant individual, and if you read the material he's put out, he lets you know that he put a report out in the year 2000 explaining about the coming terrorist attack on America, and it was very, very clear. He's saying, we're going to give the impression we're just totally incompetent. Oh, shucks, we have no idea what we're doing. And the inference is, you know, the American people will accept our story of the coming terrorist attack on America. It's a Bremer Committee report. We have it written in 2000, and that's just what he did when he got over there. He comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. He worked for Kissinger and Associates. He is closely related to the Rockefeller family, and they have created chaos there. There's no way you could have done such a poor job unintentionally, because after all, if you had a stable country, how could you justify keeping American and British troops stationed there? So, well, I personally believe that they're not stupid. I don't believe we're trying to solve the problem. If we don't have a problem, why, how would we justify staying?
Well, exactly. And, of course, there's a certain amount of talking up. People like Edward Luttrell wrote in the Sunday Telegraph a week or two ago, hinting about a withdrawal. There is a muttering from official sources or quasi-official sources along these lines. But basically, we have a tiger by the tail, and there's nothing we can do about it. And I was listening to an English brigadier who was a British brigadier who was just taking up his appointment out there, and he was making some very palliative noises about the situation calming and being under control, when the reality is it's quite the reverse. And of course, people like that can't afford to say the things in absolute bloody chaos.
But that's what it is.
His job on the spot.
But it is a bloody chaos. I think that would be the way the British would refer to it. And of course, the other thing is, they're putting NATO troops into Afghanistan. What are NATO troops going in Afghanistan? I thought they were supposed to guard the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, there were pamphlets, booklets, official ones, published about NATO, published by NATO, about 4 or 5 years ago, in which they were arguing the re-rolling of NATO, and this was part of the official talk-up, to use NATO for other purposes. In other words, for the purposes of the coalition powers, the Western powers, principally the United Kingdom and the United States.
It's really sort of a world army. Hey, we're out of time, Colonel. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. We'll look forward to having you back with us once again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Goodbye. God bless you, mate, sir. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Colonel Barry Turner. Now, if you have read my newsletters, the January, February, and March newsletters, you'll find out that when, of course, we had moved into Iraq and destroyed the Iraqi army and destroyed the Iraqi police force and destroyed and disbanded the Iraqi civil service, then we had to build a new army. So they got a Major General Paul, I believe it was, his name was Evans. Anyway, you'll find the story in one of my newsletters. I think it's probably the February or March newsletter. And this Major General was given 6 men. And his job was to build an army for a nation of 25 million people. And the Pentagon did everything they could to block efforts to build an Iraqi army. Why? So that we would have to keep our troops there. Now, this general is one of the 6 generals who's spoken out against Rumsfeld. He's now retired. He realized, of course, he'd been set up as a fall guy. How do you build an army for a nation of 25 million people with 6 full-time men. He had a few that would come in. He was promised 250 troops, but he only got about half of them, and they were only there for a short period of time. He wasn't allowed to use any of the previously trained Iraqi forces. He said, you know, trying to build an army without non-commissioned officers is like trying to put a tent up without any tent stakes or tent poles. You can't do it. So you have to understand everything they have done is to perpetuate this terrible and bloody conflict. And when you understand that, everything made sense. If you're looking for logic on what's going on today, well, you're not going to find it. And our job is to make the American people understand what's really going on. Now, you can go to our website at www.radioliberty.com and read my January, February, and March 2006 newsletters. Let me encourage you to do that. Of course, you really want to get our full set of pamphlets called Foreknowledge, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, going into the background of what happened leading up to 9/11 and what happened after that as we entered this war that will never end. In fact, that's what the Premier of Canada said on the day after 9/11, or maybe the evening of 9/11, this war will never end. You see, he understood what it was about. But the American people aren't to know that. They feel that we're fighting a war on terrorism. But if we're fighting a war on terrorism, why have we never tried to get Osama bin Laden? Why have we never tried to get Osama bin Laden? And why is it that they've never tried to close our southern borders? And why is it they won't allow racial profiling on the planes? And there's so many unanswered questions, and you need to read those newsletters or copy them and get them disseminated across America. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to finance what we do 5 hours a day. And believe me, it's an expensive proposition to be on the air, and not only on the radio, but on satellite and on shortwave and on the Internet. 5 hours a day on the Internet, 4 hours on shortwave, 9 hours on satellite. But at least we have an opportunity to reach out. And if you'd like to learn more about the satellite, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com or call me, and we'd be glad to help you learn more about what we're doing. So we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. And then, of course, to understand the spiritual forces that are at work, you need to get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy, part 1, part 2, part 3. That's the occult hierarchy. To understand what's coming down the line financially. You need to get our syllabus on the financial tsunami. And those of you who've ordered the DVD, I'm just viewing that today to make sure it's up to snuff so we can send it out. If not, we'll may have to send out videos on that on the financial tsunami. But we hope that the DVD will play and play properly. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We hope that you'll get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it and circulate it and even buy it in volume, and we'll be glad to give you a very good deal on them. If you'll buy the book and get it out to people across America, we need to get people to understand the true nature of what's going on, because there really are secret societies. There is a secret plan. In fact, certainly the Council on Foreign Relations has a plan. The communists have a plan. The Satanists and Luciferians have a plan. And God has a plan. And of course, whose side are you going to be on in this battle? Because, you know, if you're not involved, why, you're part of the problem. Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And an understanding of the forces that are shaping the events that are unfolding today is predicated not upon facts to be learned, but rather on secrets to be discovered. An understanding of the forces that are shaping the events of today is predicated not upon facts to be learned, but upon secrets to be discovered, because there are secrets. And until you understand the true meaning of the symbol, the occult symbol on the back of the dollar bill, the occult symbol of the Trilateral Commission, and you can go to their website, trilateral.org, that's trilateral.org, and go to their website and look at their emblem. What is their logo? It's a circle with three sixes, and when those sixes meet in the center, they make an upside-down broken cross. Shucks, I wonder what that represents. And, of course, who really runs the Bush administration? Certainly not George Bush. A man named Dick Cheney, who just happened to come from the Council on Foreign Relations. They put him there to control what the Bush administration does. Just as they put Paul Volcker in as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and after him, Alan Greenspan. Both of them came from the Trilateral Commission. What is the goal of the Trilateral Commission? Well, you'll certainly want to get our April newsletter. Hopefully it'll be available very soon, and it will take you into what Barry Goldwater said about the Trilateral Commission. He read about it. He studied about it. He knew the people. He was well aware of their plan. They had a very simple plan. They wanted to rule the world. And, of course, they are ruling the world today by controlling the commercial and financial interests of the entire world. And believe me, they have strong ties into China today. They believe they can control communist China. They have close relationships with people there. In fact, in August of 1973, when David Rockefeller returned from China after they'd killed almost 100 million people, David Rockefeller said, you know, the social experiment in China under Chairman Mao is one of the most important and successful in history. The social experiment in China under Chairman Mao was one of the most important and successful in history. That's the same man who said, we've been accused of being conspirators, and I plead guilty.